Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to be in Exodus 35 today. I think it's important we see the contextual flow up to this point, and we'll understand better why this seems to be such a repeat of 25 and 26 and 27 and through there, okay? Remember back in chapters 25 through 31, God has given Moses a detailed, it's just a very detailed description of the special tent of meeting. We call it the tabernacle. We get that term from the Vulgate translation. We have how long the hooks are supposed to be, what material, how thick the boards are, how many coverings, how long the string is. It's really something. 25 through 31, given on Mount Sinai. Oh, but God help them. In 32 through 34 is the golden calf. The Ten Commandments are broken. Moses has to go back up to get them. And so really, almost, it's like a covenant renewal ceremony beginning in verses 35, through 40. The tabernacle that was given in such detail back in 25 through 31 is going to be built. And there's going to be an almost brief recapitulation of the responsibilities. It's obvious it's a renewal setting. The fact that it may look like it's a greatly repeated piece of literature, but theologically it shows that even though they were unfaithful, God is going to be faithful to His promises He made earlier. I think it's very significant. Now, notice if you would that, let's go ahead and begin in verse 1 then. Then Moses assembled all the congregations of the sons of Israel, of course that means the children of Jacob, and said to them, "These are the things the Lord commanded you to do." Now it's kind of this renewal thing. "For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord." Now why go back over this? Well, it's an obvious allusion to the beginning of the Ten Commandments. Now, this 6 days for work, we go back to Genesis, and work was done by Adam in the garden before the fall. But after the fall, work became a burden. Man had to work to live, and so it becomes a hard thing, but it was not meant to be. Notice it says, though, "and on the seventh day." Now, this seventh day, the number seven became a number of perfection in the Bible. I really think it's kind of what the tithe is in the Old Testament. As man gave 10% to God for the tabernacle and the priesthood, it was a way of saying all of man's money belonged to God. As man gave the first fruits to God as a symbol of thanksgiving and God owned the whole crop, it was the idea that the whole crop belonged to Him. That man had 6 days he could work, but the seventh day was the Lord's, is a way of showing that all days belong to God. So this idea of a week, seven-day week, is a very ancient idea. It's unique to the Hebrews, for other peoples had different settings of time. The Egyptians had 10 days of focus and all. So that we have a week today kind of goes back to this very ancient custom. Now the Sabbath, of course, because the Jews believe that going back to Genesis 1, the evening and the morning were the first day, they begin their Sabbath, or this holy day, at 6 p.m. Friday, and it runs till 6 p.m. Saturday. Now, notice it says, "Sabbath of complete rest." The word Sabbath means a cessation of work. And so here it's almost like a doublet. Sabbath means a complete rest. "To the Lord." It was a unique worship day to Yahweh. "Whoever does any work shall be put to death." We only have one account of this happening in Numbers 15, 32 through 36, where a man was found collecting sticks, implication to make a fire on the Sabbath, and this congregation stoned him. Now listen, verse 3, and this is unique. This is not repeated in chapters 25 through 31. "You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." Now, the rabbis are kind of split over this. One says it shows that no work was to be done, and this was a type of work, defined what work is to, in a way. Others say no, it refers to building a fire to melt metal to work on the tabernacle. I'm not sure that last one has any validity whatsoever. Although it's not mentioned in earlier in 25 or elsewhere in the Bible about not building a fire on the Sabbath, it is strongly implied in Exodus 16:23. Now let's begin in chapters 4 and following. And Moses spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the thing the Lord has commanded, saying, take from among you a contribution to the Lord, whoever is of a willing heart." Now this is interesting. Whoever is of a willing heart. It was not a command. It was a voluntary response. But the idea is that God is going to touch the hearts of the men and women, and they're going to freely give. It was voluntary, but the implication is the Spirit is going to touch their hearts. Now this same thrust is repeated in verses 21 and 22, verses 26 and 29. The same thrust, all who is willing. We learn from chapter 36, verse 2, that they were so willing that Moses finally had to tell them, stop, don't bring any more. Now, let him bring it as the Lord's contribution, gold, silver, and bronze. Now, it's interesting to me, this gold, silver, and bronze kind of moves from precious metals to lesser precious metals. Also, this description of the tabernacle beginning in verse 12 is going to move from the inner part, holy, which was mostly made of things of gold. And it's going to move outward. Now, you can't say exactly that the metal corresponds to this movement because there was some parts of bronze used in the tent itself. But the silver was always used for like the hooks and the building parts, where the gold was used for the major pieces of furniture. And the bronze was used for kind of holding the tent together in its different places. Now, it can't be brass, because this is probably a combination of copper and tin. They hadn't learned all the metal by this point. Some say that they got these metals from two sources. One, from the Egyptians that gave it to them, and that we learned earlier that God said he was going to do that in chapter 3. It happened in chapter 3, verse 22, and it literally is shown historically in chapter 11, verse 2. And so I think they got it from the Egyptians. Others say, well, it was too much to got from the Egyptians. So maybe they got it from the Midianites, who we know were miners in this Sinai Peninsula for many, many decades before this. There is gold in Sinai, and there is silver in Sinai, and so it's been easily gotten as well as mined as well as from jewelry. Now, notice it mentions then, let's see, and blue, purple, and scarlet material, fine linen, and goat's hair. Now, Egypt is known for its weaving of a twisting of cloth to make bolts of material to cut garments out of. And so, obviously, these slaves had learned that in Egypt. Now, these colors, let's look at them. My New American Standard has blue. This is an Akkadian word that means a violet blue. The second one, purple, is a Sanskrit word that means reddish purple. And the word scarlet is a term that is used, we get the word cinnamon from it, the Arabic root. It came from an insect that was crushed up and used for dye. So all these different colors would mean a reddish purple, something like that. A fine linen and goat's hair. And ram skins dyed red and porpoise skins and acacia wood. And let's talk about that. There's a lot of misunderstanding here. We're not sure exactly what all this means. It's obvious what ram skins are, and they would have easily had that. The word dyed red, some say it simply means tanned. And in the process of tanning, the leather turned this color because of the chemicals they used from the desert area. Now, whether they dyed it red or it turned red in tanning is uncertain. My opinion is it turned a kind of red in the tanning process. Now, what about these porpoise skins? How would they have got porpoise skins in the middle of the desert? Well, they either brought them from Egypt, or somehow when the Red Sea, or really Reed Sea, maybe there were some animals that died in that, and they skinned them. I don't know. I really think that what it is the Egyptian word for leather. And so it doesn't mean porpoise skins at all, but just leather skins from an Egyptian root, and that makes more sense to me. And acacia wood. Now, this is interesting. I have a picture of an Akkadian tree here. It's not a real unusual tree. It's kind of a low desert bush. This comes from the Illustrated Family Encyclopedia. It's a beautiful reference work. It's interesting to me that as God spoke to Moses out of a burning bush, a common little desert bush, he builds his tabernacle from common desert trees. They're called acacia trees. Or sometimes in Deuteronomy, they're called shittim. Now, it's kind of a gnarly wood, but it's not real tall, but it is very hard, and it smells good. And so a lot of people would make things from this. Even today, they make cabinets from this, and it's a very beautiful wood. It was available, too. That's also helpful. Verse 8, oil for the lighting and spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense. Now, these different kind of oil would mostly be olive oil, and it would be used for the lighting of the different fires, particularly like the menorah or the lampstand in the holy place. And then this anointing oil would be for anointing the priest and different things that were anointed to cleanse them and anoint them. And then, of course, the fragrant incense would be for the incense altar that was right before the veil. And I'm going to show you in a minute a picture of this, and we'll put them all in place. So the incense was to make a cloud of smoke. For anybody who believed they saw God, they would die. So the smoke was to fill this inner chamber called the Holy of Holies, in which the high priest entered only once a year. We learned this from Leviticus 16, called the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur, the Day of Covering. Now, listen, verse 9, and onyx stones. Now, what are they for? Well, we're going to learn in just a minute that the onyx stones and their setting are for the ephod, which is the next word. Now, what is an ephod? Well, an ephod was kind of like a vest. It was made out of the same material, this bluish, reddish purple. And it was a vest that was going to hold the breast piece where all these jewels, one for each tribe. It's going to have two onyx stones on each shoulder, six of the tribes on each. It's going to have a gold chain that comes down on which the breastplate, a plate of gold, about 9 or so inches square, with four rows of three stones each. So this ephod is a rather unusual term. It's hard for us to lock down what it means because in different places it means different things. Example, it is used in Judges 8:27 for almost a man-sized idol. It's used in 1 Samuel 23:9-11 for something with which you try to find the will of God. And then it's used here as an obvious vest or piece of clothing for the priest. And it says, and the breast piece. As the ephod is described in detail in Exodus 28:6-14, so the breast piece is described in great detail in Exodus 28:15-30. It had these beautiful stones on it, and its basic purpose was not only to, it's called the breast piece of judgment. These stones were on the front, and I think a picture of the high priest is a beautiful sign of the elegance of this. And behind these stones was a little pouch. And in them were the Urim and the Thummim, the lights and the perfections they're sometimes called. We're not exactly sure what they are. Some say it's a set of bones with certain letters carved on them, or a yes and a no. But it was some way to determine the will of God, and it was in the back of this breastplate on the high priest. And of course, you know, the priest were not only a way to sacrifice, but were for teaching and for judgment, and particularly the high priest, to know the will of God. And then in verse 10, let every skilled man among you come. Now, the every skilled man among you seems to imply that everyone who had any carpentry or weaving skills could be involved. It's a way in which the entire congregation could participate, not only with their contributions, but with their skills. Now, we're going to learn from over in verses 30 down through 34, there are two men that are uniquely gifted by God, one from the tribe of Judah and one from the tribe of Dan, that will lead them and overall kind of supervise the work. But here, everybody is to have a part if they want to. And make all that the Lord has commanded. Verse 11, the tabernacle. Now, the tabernacle, we get that word from the Vulgate. The Hebrew word seems to mean the tent of meeting. Or maybe in this context of the golden calf debacle, which really wasn't idolatry, but it was making an image of Yahweh, that maybe the tent of reunion would be a better sense. This is the place that Moses would meet God. It becomes the symbol of the presence of God. There are two different parts in the Old Testament. One say the tabernacle was right in the middle of the camp of Israel, and other says because of the sin of Israel, it was moved right outside the camp. Now, the implication is that it was a symbol of God dwelling among his people. And it was a way of God showing, I am with you, I love you, I care for you. We see in certain pictures that it was the Shekinah cloud of glory that often came down on this tabernacle, particularly the inner tent of meeting, when Moses approached the Lord. I have this picture here I want to show you. It comes from the Mennonite Visitor Center, I believe in Pennsylvania, and it kind of shows you the tabernacle with the camp of the tribes of Israel around it. And notice the Shekinah glory is right above the place where the Holy of Holies would be, which is the Ark of the Covenant. Isn't that a beautiful picture? Can you see it there? I think it's just gorgeous. Now, notice if you would where, that's what the tabernacle is all about. And then it says the tent. Now, the tent, if the tabernacle was about, had a perimeter of about 300 cubits, 100 cubits on a side and then 50 cubits, it's always going to have one opening that faced east. Now, the tent, we're never told where inside of this enclosure the tent is, though most people believe it is centered toward the back or to the west end of the tent. Now, it was about 45 feet by 15 feet, and it was a long rectangle made up of two compartments. An inner one, or the back one, was a perfect cube, 10 cubits by 10 cubits, and the outer one, 20 cubits. Now, the size of a cubit has been some discussion. It's the length from a man's longest finger to his elbow. It varied from 17 to 21 inches, the royal cubit being 21, the normal cubit being 18, so there's some variety here of exactly what size it is. But it was a perfect cube, and in this little room with its own special curtain is where the Ark of the Covenant sat. And we'll get to that piece of furniture, and I'll talk about that more in just a minute. But this first little room is called the Holy of Holies. Now, the outer room, which is twice as long, is called the Holy Place. It has its own veil at the very front, but of cheaper material and without the picture of the cherubim or these angelic creatures that seem to be close to God, okay? Now, notice it mentions the tent and its coverings. Now, from this same encyclopedia, it was I don't know if you can see this picture here. I'll give you a close-up in just a minute. It shows there are three different coverings. The inner covering of fine material, very colorful, very beautiful, purple, that purple. An outer covering of a goat skin, and then another cover of leather. Now, we're not sure exactly how these were put together, if it's a flat roof or a peaked roof as far as the leather. But it's obvious the leather outer skin was to protect it from the weather. And yet it was very capable of being taken down very rapidly and moved. Everything had rings that could be moved quickly. And now some say this leather pouch was really what these tents were tucked up and put into when they traveled. And there is some ambiguity here we can't be certain on. Before I did this lesson, I was looking at the Biblica Judaica versus the Zondervan Encyclopedia, and they're quite different some in how they picture this, which just means we have no real idea. With its hooks and its boards and its bars and its pillars and its sockets, which are given in detail in chapter 25 through 31. It's acacia wood, either overlaid with gold or inlaid with gold or silver or bronze, depending what it was used for. Then in verse 12, it says the ark. The word ark here is not really ark like Noah's ark or the ark that Moses was put in. It really should be chest. Now, there's some difference of agreement about what the size of it. Some say it's 4 feet by 2.5 feet by 2.5 feet. Others say, no, it's 2.5 feet by 1.5 feet. And I'm not sure exactly we know. It depends on the size of a cubit. It was like a hollow box. It was overlaid with gold. It had rings in which poles went through. The poles were never moved. And inside, certain things were put, we learned from different parts of the Pentateuch. The Ten Commandments and the broken pieces of the Ten Commandments. Later on, a certain size jar of manna. Aaron's rod that buds. Beside the ark were put things like the golden hemorrhoids and the little golden mice of 1 Samuel. We're not sure exactly what went in versus what was put beside it. But it was obviously a very significant thing. Before the children of Israel crossed the Jordan, it was the Shekinah cloud of glory that symbolized the presence of God sitting in the Holy of Holies. But after they crossed the Jordan, the Shekinah cloud disappeared, and this Ark of the Covenant became the central presence of God. We learn from Psalms 99 that it was like God lived in heaven, but His feet sat on this Ark of the Covenant. In between the wings of these two little angelic creatures called cherubim, they're discussed in Exodus 25, 18 through 20, though they're not described here at all in Exodus 35. We learn about them, particularly the detailed description, from Ezekiel chapter 1, where they're not named, and then Ezekiel 10, where they are named. And so their wings would touch in the middle, and God symbolically dwelled between the wings of the cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the high priest would come in here. We learned from Leviticus 16 and Leviticus 23, this lid is called the covering, a special lid called the mercy seat. We see it right down here next after the poles. It was a word in Hebrew for covering, and that's where the high priest put the blood for his own sins and then the blood for the nation of Israel. And it's kind of like as God symbolically looked down through the wings of these cherubim, before he came to see his covenant with his people, he would see the blood of the sacrifice and that the people's sins would be cleansed. The most beautiful discussion of this, as far as its spiritual significance, is the book of Hebrews that says that Jesus Christ's blood cleanses from all sin, that he is the perfect sacrifice, that he is both the high priest and the sacrifice, and his sacrifice is once and for all. Now, many people have made a lot of speculation about the colors and the metals and the furniture and all the symbolism. All of those different symbolisms the different authors use never agree because the Bible is silent. I personally am reluctant to write in or put in symbolism that the authors did not see themselves because they are the only inspired ones. So I prefer not to read a lot of symbolism in here, but simply to take it as a historical account of the description of the place of worship. And I think it does show the holiness of God. It does provide for the sacrificial system. But I wouldn't read too much in it. Example, the furniture makes a cross and all that. I think that's just a bit much. Now, notice it does mention the mercy seat here, and it means to cover. You might want to see Leviticus 23:27. And the curtain of the screen. This is the special curtain that blocks off the Holy of Holies from the holy place. You might want to see Exodus 26:31-37. And then we come to the table. Now, the table here is the table on which this special bread of the presence. We learn from chapter 25, verses 23 and following, that it was on, chapter 26, verse 35, that it's on the north side, as the tent always faced east. As a man faced east, the north would be to the right and east to the left and the west to his back. So the north side, the bread was very large, somewhere it was almost 2.5 to 3 pounds, large loaves. Now, some books say it was replaced every day and the priest ate it. Other people interpret to say it was replaced only on the Sabbath. It seems to me from my reading it was replaced only on the Sabbath, but there is some disagreement there. Exactly why bread, we're not sure, unless it's the ideal of God providing bread daily. Okay? It's in the holy place, not the Holy of Holies, and it's on the right side as you face inward. Okay, let's go then to verse 14, the lamp. Now, the Hebrew word for lamp is menorah. We learn from Exodus 25, 33 and following, it was a seven-pointed. It had three branches on each side and a central branch, and they were made of almond buds, or the cups, and the priest would light them. Now, some say they were lit all the time. Some say only lit at night. Again, we're not sure. There's some ambiguity, but it gave light to the holy place. In Solomon's temple, there's going to be 10 branches, but here only seven, three on one side, three on the other, and the central pillar. It was a gold, and it has utensils to which you fill it up and all that. The altar of incense, and you might well see chapter 30, verses 1 through 10. This is not discussed in Exodus 25, 26, 27, but it is in chapter 30, 1 through 10. It was a small little incense altar. The coals were taken from the large altar of sacrifice out in front of the smaller tent of meeting, and then it was put on this incense altar. Incense was placed on here. It smelled good. It made a tremendous cloud that covered the presence of God, maybe to mask this Shekinah cloud. And it was right in the Holy of Holies, right next to this special veil. Then we have the altar of burnt offerings, which was a bronze altar. It seems it was 7.5 feet, though it was much bigger than that in Solomon's temple. That's described in 27:1-8. Now, it had a veil also, as mentioned here, and a veil right in before that altar, and it is of less significant material, and there's no cherubim. You might want to see chapter 26, verses 36 and 37. And there's a screen to the outer court mentioned in verse 17. Then we have the holy garments in verse 19. I wish you had time to go through all that. I don't. Many of them are being discussed, the ephod and all of that. What we don't have discussed is the turban and the robe and the sash, and you can see chapter 28, verses 1 through 5 in chapter 28, verses 30 through 39. Then in verse 20 down through 29, it just describes the men and women bringing things. And then in 30 and following, it names these two men. One of them is named Biziel from the tribe of Judah, and one is named Holadab from the tribe of Dan. They're discussed here, and they're very knowledgeable in what they do. They're skilled people. They're going to teach people how to work on this thing. Notice in verse 35 it says that God filled them with skill. As God seemed to say, anyone who would can work, he filled two men with unique skill to teach. As God said, come and bring your contributions, and men brought it, and then men wanted to work on it. So a whole community was involved in this tabernacle. It was the central piece of their religious life. It was in the center of their camp when they camped. It housed the most holy thing they had, the Ark of the Covenant. During the wilderness wandering period, the Shekinah cloud would be over that in the day and night and would lead them as the tribe moved. This is a beautiful picture of the worship of the ancient Hebrew people. It's surprising it's not mentioned much once we get outside the wilderness wandering periods. We have it in the time of David's son, but after Solomon builds his temple, we don't hear about it much. It's the book of Hebrews in the New Testament that makes such a big deal out of it, and then the book of Exodus in the Old Testament that shows how significant it was. Again, be careful of reading too much of an allegorical sense in here. I think we can see by the holiness that moves inward and goes outward that man was to approach God in a unique way, that the blood of bulls and goats was take away sin as a symbol, and that God dwelt with his people. And that's basically what this chapter is all about. God let his people help and turn their hearts to him to do it. May it be so today. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. Have a good day.